This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with guest Danny Greenberg and learn how FEMA was trying to evict Hurricane Katrina victims from temporary hotels.
Saved at the last minute, 150,000 people about to be put out on the street.
Guest Bill Goodman from the Center for Constitutional Rights will talk about illegal government domestic electronic surveillance and also give us an update on the Alito nomination.
If you ever thought your phone calls were safe, don't think it after you listen to this show.
And we'll be joined by guest Clark Kissinger to talk about an upcoming war crimes tribunal against President Bush.
We can't get any court in this country to try Bush for his crimes, so we're setting up our own. Come to the tribunal, January 20th. It begins at Riverside. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, ACLU's Arab Muslim South Asian advocate.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Meet the king of cowboys, he rides a pale pony. He fights the bad boys, brings them to their knees. He patrols the highways from the air.
Heidi, you know, we've had some extraordinary developments in Congress and with the president concerning Guantanamo and torture over the Christmas-New Year's break. Pretty amazing stuff, actually. Two amendments I want to talk about that were passed and signed by the president on December 30th. One I'm sure a lot of our listeners have heard of. It's called the McCain Amendment. That was supposed to ban cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, which is sort of a lesser form of torture, although, of course, it's already been banned in American law, but this administration decided for a while it wasn't. And so Congress said to them in the McCain Amendment, or was trying to say, we're going to ban it again. And the other amendment is the Graham-Levin Amendment that deeply affects what happens in the Guantanamo cases going forward. So I want to talk about those two amendments a little bit and then what happened when the president signed those amendments into law.
On the McCain Amendment, did that get watered down from how it was initially proposed?
Well, you know, the McCain Amendment, as I said, prohibits cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. But the answer is yes, it got watered down. And it got watered down in a way that is really nasty. They tried to exempt the CIA from it for a while, and then they tried to exempt anybody not in U.S. military custody. They couldn't get that through, but they did get through a defense for soldiers who torture, is what you might want to call it. And it says that a soldier who doesn't believe that he's breaking the law shouldn't be found criminally liable for torture. Well, that's not that dissimilar to the current standard for war crimes, with one big, big twist. They actually put into the legislation a paragraph that said, and it shall be a defense to that soldier if he is relying on a legal opinion that says that what he is doing is lawful. Now, what does that remind you of, Heidi? Does it remind you of anything?
Oh, the U Amendment,
I would
right.
call this not the McCain Amendment. This is the U Amendment. John U is now a professor at Berkeley, but was a big advisor to Bush on torture, etc. He's the one who said you can torture in the name of national security. Things like waterboarding, etc., don't really constitute torture. It narrowed the definition of torture. What this McCain Amendment is now doing, it's saying on one hand, yes, we're banning torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. But on the other hand, if there's a legal opinion out there by people like John Yoo, which our administration is purposely generating so that we can allow torture, then a soldier who carries out torture cannot be prosecuted.
Now, what about the supervisors of those soldiers? Are they liable for anything?
Same business.
Because of the memo.
If they have a legal memo, I won't necessarily, it's the UN anymore, but whatever memos are out there that are secret, they will be able to torture under McCain because they're relying on a legal opinion of this administration.
So there's really no bite to this amendment.
Well, there was never a lot of bite in the sense that there was no way to enforce the thing. It's not criminal. It's, you know, this
stuff
is all.
So it's a symbolic gesture.
It was something that, as I told people, and this was an interesting lobbying issue that came up, at the point at which this was being lobbied for, and they were also going to strip our Guantanamo detainees of jurisdiction in Graham Levin, which we'll talk about, I said, forget both these bills. Just strip them both out, I said to the human rights groups. These are no good. McCain is not really going to do anything. It's words you can put over your bed and look in at night, but it's not going to help anybody. And particularly with what I would call the U amendment in this thing, it's no good at all. And I wouldn't call this the McCain amendment. I would call this the John U amendment. Mm-hmm. So we now have Congress having passed and the president signing the McCain amendment that, in my view, allows torture if there's a legal memo. And then you get to the real kicker in the McCain amendment, which is the president's signing statement. When the president signs legislation, you know, Congress passes it both houses and he signs it and then becomes law, he frequently or often issues what's called a presidential signing statement saying, oh, this was great. We finally got this done. I'm really happy about this. This time he gave a real kicker. And if you want to talk about police state, if you want to talk about what I sometimes refer to as Fuhrer's law, in other words, the law of the Fuhrer, that whatever the president says goes, look at the signing statement on the McCain Amendment. Because as bad as the McCain Amendment is, what the president said when he signed it, he says, well, I'm glad Congress did this. We both have our goal of wanting to stop terrorism, and my constitutional powers will not be affected by this. And if I feel, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, but if I feel it's necessary to continue to use coercive methods, cruel and human and degrading treatment on detainees, I will still do it. Congress cannot affect my constitutional right, nor can the courts, to do what I need to protect national security. So what you're seeing here is a utter and complete grab for executive power that you have to say is akin to the Fuhrer's law or dictatorship. It's a remarkable, remarkable statement. It's called the signing statement. We can put it up on our website, yes. Law and Disorder. When you read it, it looks like gobbledygook because it goes all around circles and everything. But in the end, what it says is the president can do no wrong, the king can do no wrong, and he can do whatever he wants. That's the story of McCain and the signing amendment. I sit here and I think not only am I angry at the president about it, but I'm angry at anybody, even McCain at this point, who thought that first by adding that little piece in there that the right to whatever a lawyer says in the administration protects you. And then we get to the big one for me personally and for the center is the kick in the teeth we got from the other amendment called the Graham-Levin Amendment.
Pretty sad times with such an overexertion of executive power.
Well, you know, the Graham-Levin Amendment, which is the other half of this bad piece of pie, the one that affects Guantanamo. It initially started out with a Republican senator named Senator Graham who put in something that would have taken away any jurisdiction in the courts to deal with Guantanamo at all. In other words, right now we're sitting here with Guantanamo. We won a case called Razul, the Center for Constitutional Rights did in 2004. That gave rights to people at Guantanamo to go to court and to test their detention, gave the right to sue for torture, for a variety of things you could do in Guantanamo. We have some 500 lawyers working on this. We have habeas corpus petitions, which are the right to test your detention petitions, really, filed in district court in Washington. We're litigating due process. We've had hundreds of visits go to Guantanamo. We've really put back and essentially stopped the torture at Guantanamo and exposed it to the world. Well, what comes along but Senator Graham out of North Carolina? And in this amendment, he joins up with Senator Levin, what I would call a wolf in sheep's clothing, so-called liberal from Michigan, agrees to this amendment, and the amendment does the following things. And you have to listen carefully because it's really incredible to me. It does three or four things that are really absolutely amazing. One is it says that federal courts no longer have jurisdiction or can no longer hear any cases coming out of Guantanamo that are habeas corpus cases. This is a right that's been enshrined, of course, in our Constitution since its founding and really goes back to the Magna Carta in 1215. So it strips the courts. We argue that it only strips the courts of cases going forward. Government argues and is first week in January, has started to put in papers to try and get rid of all of these hundreds of habeas corpus cases.
So it applies retroactively.
They're trying to say it applies to every single case. So that's number one thing that Graham Levin does. The second thing it does, it says that any of our clients in Guantanamo can no longer sue for torture or for the conditions of their detention. So we have clients down there with lawsuits saying, I'm being held in solitary 24 hours a day. I'm not being let out. I'm being put in Camp 5, the worst camp. I'm being tortured. Dogs are going in and all this kind of stuff. It bars any kind of suit having to do with conditions at Guantanamo. So it creates really, between those two, it creates essentially an offshore prison camp that's made permanent. So if you look at deeply what it's done, not only is the Congress going along in this whole business, which is an outrage, but it's nullifying a Supreme Court opinion that we won in 2004. So those are two of the really nasty things it does.
And without having those options, then the world can't hear about what's going on.
Right. The only thing it allows is a little escape valve, is it says that after there's some kind of hearing that the military gives you down in Guantanamo, you can go up to a middle court, a court of appeals, and just make sure that the procedures are complied with. It's no real review. I'm hopeful they don't, but we'll try and cut off attorney access to Guantanamo detainees. Mm-hmm. We won't have any factual hearings in federal courts any longer, according to this legislation. It's really a nasty business, and it's the first time the habeas corpus statute has been amended since this country was founded, since the statute was put on the books in 1789. The only other suspension of the writ we've ever had of the writ of habeas corpus was during the Civil War, and that was a suspension. It wasn't a permanent excluding from the writ of habeas corpus, the fundamental protection of our liberty, permanent excluding by Congress. When I say it's fundamental protection, you know, habeas corpus is fundamental because it's the one that says, President, you can't simply pick up people by the scruff of their neck.
Arbitrarily
put them in jail and not give them any access to the court. Mm. And that's what our fine senators and our Congress and our House and our president have done. That's two parts of the Graham Levin. The third one, a real clinker here, you know, normally when you get evidence from someone from torture or from cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or coercion, that evidence can't be used against you in a court because it's not reliable, and we don't want to encourage the police to torture you. What does Graham Levin say? Graham Levin says that evidence from coercion can be used in court if it's probative. In other words, if it has some value and if the court determines or whatever tribunal they're in front of, if it has some value in terms of whether you're enemy combatant or guilty of something.
Although we know that such evidence, the way it's obtained, precludes it being of any worth.
It's worthless. In Guantanamo, it's particularly worthless because we're talking about everything from dogs to beatings to isolation. Mm-hmm. And yet this legislation says that evidence from coercion can be used in a court. Absolutely remarkable. It's a clear violation of the law. It could never happen in a U.S. court here, but because these are special courts held in Guantanamo or special hearings, it may happen, unfortunately, down there. It's a clear violation of the Convention Against Torture. Article 15 absolutely prohibits this, and it's contrary to what the British House of Lords just decided, that you could never use evidence like this in a court.
Michael, how is this going to affect the ongoing litigation of the Center for Constitutional Rights?
Well, the week of January 7th, the government is filing in hundreds of these cases essentially a position that these courts no longer have jurisdiction of these cases. They will try and rid the courts of all these cases. And it's only about one thing. It's about the ability and the belief by the president and this administration that it can hold people forever in an offshore detention facility and treat them with torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and they don't want any court looking at what they're doing. So if we're talking about a police state after this legislation, what can you say? This is Fuhrer's law. This is the president saying, I can do whatever I want with human beings.
And our human rights record in terms of how we're viewed around the world continues to plummet to an all-time low.
Well, it's hopeless. I mean, basically, it's done for. I mean, when you have the most powerful democracy in the world tearing up the fabric of human rights in the future, what are you going to say to the Pinochets of the world? We did it, but you can't. I mean, you can say it, but it's not going to have a lot of weight.
Thank you for those updates, Michael.
Thank you.
Thanks to a recent court victory, tens of thousands of adults and children victimized by Hurricane Katrina will not be evicted from temporary hotels. The law firm Schulte, Roth & Zabel and the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law filed a lawsuit seeking a temporary restraining order to prevent FEMA from evicting victims whose applications for temporary housing benefits are still pending. On December 12th, the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Louisiana granted the temporary restraining order, enjoining FEMA from evicting them until at least 2 weeks after they receive their benefits or denial of such benefits, up until February 7th. Joining us today to talk about this victory is Danny Greenberg, Special Counsel for Pro Bono Work from Schulte, Roth & Zabel. Welcome to Law & Disorder, Danny.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Heidi.
Let's first set the scene for listeners. After the Red Cross placed evacuees in hotels, FEMA then took over the program, but subsequently announced that it would cease funding in early January.
That's right. Actually, the first they announced was they were about to suspend all payments in mid-December. The background a little bit for listeners is that a wonderful organization, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, contacted private firms to ask whether somebody could partner with them in bringing an action against FEMA, largely because FEMA, it's been documented that FEMA hadn't done the things that it needed to do. And my firm, Schulte, Roth & Zabel, undertook to work with John Britton, another National Lawyers Guild member, I might add, a former president of the organization, in providing really a lot of help in doing the case. In the midst of suing on behalf of those people who hadn't yet gotten their benefits, even though several months had passed, it came to our attention, exactly as you said, that FEMA had announced that it was going to cut off hotel payments in the middle of December. And so we amended the complaint that we brought to also ask for a temporary restraining order to forbid FEMA from cutting off those benefits to people whose applications hadn't been acted upon, or those whose applications had been chilled and even being filed.
Danny, just a question. What would have happened to people had their payments been cut off?
They would have become homeless. They would have been in the street. Quite a dramatic moment occurred in court, Michael, when in the closing to the federal judge, we actually got to say, because one of the class members I examined was a pregnant woman with an 8-year-old, we actually got to say to the judge, "Judge, in all of the precedents we've looked for, we only found one precedent where a pregnant woman at the end of December was told that there's no room at the inn." But fortunately, Your Honor, that came from a foreign jurisdiction in the Supreme Court.
It's That's great.
That you don't have to follow it.
How many people are involved that would have been thrown out of their hotel rooms?
According to FEMA's estimates, there are 150,000.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Danny, how did the situation arise that the applications for temporary housing were not processed after all these months?
Well, there probably has been nothing as unprecedented as this storm from the beginning. We all in the country watched in horror, and thereafter the human-made disaster unfolded in the weeks and months going forward. Our lawsuit tried to be as low on rhetoric as we could. There are great bars to being able to sue the federal government. There are immunity claims that the government puts forward and great discretionary claims. And we felt that to sue for damages, actual damages for the people affected, it was clear that that would have been dismissed.
Just to clarify for listeners, when you say discretionary or immunity issues, basically FEMA defended its actions by saying that things that it did or didn't do were discretionary in nature.
Well, exactly. There were really two main thrusts to it. First, the government has natural immunity. This comes from the king not being able to be sued in ancient England. And that notion that the government can't be sued except when it gives permission to be sued is really a great part of our jurisprudence. And actually, in the law that talks about FEMA, the Stafford Act, there are some statements about the fact that you can't sue FEMA. Now, there are some exceptions generally to a notion of not being able to sue the government. And one of them is if you sue for injunctive relief, if you're saying merely we want to enforce that the government has to do what it's supposed to do, you sometimes can get around immunity claims in that way. The second problem we faced was that in the statute itself, Almost all of the parts of the statute say FEMA may. And they again raised the notion that this meant that there was discretion. Once FEMA goes ahead and promulgates rules, once it has its own rules, it has to follow them. And it can't just give tall white guys named Dave benefits and deny them to other people.
One of the things that was mentioned is this, what's called the shared household rule. Some applicants were denied assistance because they lived or shared the same address or phone number with another applicant.
That's right. I mean, the goal was, not irrationally, to say that if mom, dad, and two kids lived together, and then suddenly they were all living together, but each one of them filed a separate application, you couldn't give each of them the separate benefits. The problem with that, of course, is that we all know that there are families made up of people who are split apart, so that you really could have families with people living in different places now, and each of them did independently need some sort of aid. But the second thing was, there were a lot of unrelated people who lived together. They may have lived together in Louisiana because it made sense if they had worked down there and were people who were just living together because they were roommates, or they even may have had been in a rooming house with the same address. The mechanistic way that FEMA was looking at applications were that if there was the same address, they just denied the second person who went ahead and applied. And one of the things that we got them to change was the implementation of that shared household.
Danny, can you give me some sense of the timeline, like when you won, what you won, and how long it's going to protect people for, and what might happen next?
Sure. The case was filed in late November with a date given to us of early December to be in court. The judge issued his order on December 12th. That order said that the December 15th date had to be put forward and people couldn't be evicted before January 7th. As we approached January 7th in the new year, we recognized that FEMA itself had put in legal papers saying that it wasn't sure who was living in the hotel. So we went back to court. We're actually going to file tomorrow. The January 7th date the government has voluntarily put off, Michael. They are not going to evict anybody on January 7th. And one of the roles of media is to let people know that. People in hotels should have had notices placed under their door by the contracting agency that FEMA works for.
And this is some 150,000 people spread out in hotels, not just in New Orleans, but all over the country?
It's a nationwide, we're asking for nationwide class status, and this order by FEMA itself is that there will be no evictions on the 7th.
That's just incredible, really.
And
wonderful.
It is wonderful, and we're trying to get that date now solidified into February. We're back in court on February the 11th to argue some motions, including what may be our own new restraining order, saying that although FEMA has put it off from January 7th, we want a date certain, and we don't want it just left up to FEMA to be able to say anytime after the 7th to say they're going to go forward. We have a motion that will be back in front of the judge.
But what ultimately happens here? I mean, you keep people in the hotels for a period of time, and then are they supposed to get benefits at some point?
Right.
Where are they supposed to go?
Well, look, let's start with an overall picture. There's homelessness all over the country. This storm has exacerbated the problems that poor people face. No one in my law firm is naive enough to believe that we're going to solve what is the underlying problem of poverty and homelessness. Our goal is merely, in a larger context, to get FEMA to do its job, to give people benefits if they're entitled to it, to deny applications if people aren't entitled to it, but to act on every application and to act on it lawfully. In the interim, until that happens, we've gotten a judge to agree that FEMA can't take the only safety net that's still available to them, namely these hotels, and kick them out of those hotels. So on the one hand, like any litigation that progressive lawyers ever do, we're extremely proud and understand the importance of what we're doing. But on the other hand, don't want to blow this out of proportion. The problem of those evacuees, they are largely poor. They are largely people of color. Many of them are now located in areas that they don't even have the support mechanisms they used to have. And the government, which ostensibly has an entire agency set up to be an emergency management agency to help them, is woefully not doing what it's supposed to do. We hope to be able to get to people the amounts of money, in this case it's about $2,500 as an initial grant, to at least be able to have something in hand.
Your firm put in, what, something like 3,000 pro bono hours on this? And how many lawyers worked on it?
Well, that's right. From we actually track hours, as you could imagine. And what I know right now is that from the last week of September only through the end of November, the firm put in over 3,000 hours. By now, it's clearly closer to 4,000 or 5,000 hours. We had about 20 associates and two partners working on it. I'm lucky enough in my position now, as you've described to listeners, to be the pro bono special counsel for pro bono initiatives at the firm. And I think it is important to say in this context that we think of progressive lawyering coming out of the progressive guild firms. We think of legal services, of course, in the Legal Aid Society all over the country, those organizations with full-time people who are passionate and do extraordinary work, the death penalty lawyers, the Guantanamo cases. But the Guantanamo cases in this one is an example that listeners should remember come from large firm practice. There are very decent people in firms, and a lot of them want to do what's right, not because they're necessarily even very progressive in their politics, but they know that it's important for lawyers to do things that are right, that fairness is important, that keeping the system open is important. So it's been an extraordinary effort about which I am extraordinarily proud, and the firm is quite also happy to be doing it.
Danny, before we go, could you briefly describe what it was like down there in New Orleans?
Well, you know, when I ran the Legal Aid Society, our office was across the street from the World Trade Center. And I saw that devastation literally a half a block away and worked down there in the ensuing weeks and months. To have experienced that, however, can't prepare somebody for what you experienced down in the areas hit by this storm. We are talking about miles and miles, as far as you could see, of completely empty houses with water marked high above your head, with the possessions of a lifetime lying in rubble, refrigerators on top of notebooks, on top of clothing, on top of stoves, as whole houses have just been put out into the street. No electricity still of New Orleans. And as always, it's the poor who are most disproportionately hurt by these things. So I think until you're there, you don't have a sense of the enormity of how many people were affected by this. Everybody needs to be helping in all the ways that we possibly can.
That's true. Danny, we really appreciate your coming on, and it was very heartening to hear about how the law firm has helped in this measure. We hope you'll return one day to Law and Disorder with an update.
I'm always glad. It's a terrific show, and the people that you have always tell us things that we might not otherwise hear in other places.
And thank you and your colleagues, particularly. And Danny, I'm glad you're there as their pro bono coordinator.
Me too. Thanks a lot, Michael. Keep up your good work, too.
Pleased to have Clark Kissinger with us. He's the convener of the International Commission of Inquiry on Crimes Against Humanity, committed by the Bush administration here in the United States. It's going to be held at the Riverside Church on January 20th, 21st, and 22nd. Clark Kissinger and I were at the University of Wisconsin together. Clark goes all the way back.
He was the main organizer for the historic 1965 anti-Vietnam War demonstration in Washington, D.C., which started it all off. And he hasn't stopped since. It's been 40 years, and now he's organizing this commission. Clark, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, and it couldn't be more timely given what's happened in just the last few weeks.
Yeah, no kidding. That's what we've been talking about. Clark, tell us, what's at stake here, and what is the commission attempting to achieve?
One of the things that we want to do is to bring together in one place the full extent of the criminality of this administration. And at the same time, we've tried to set some rigorous standards in terms of what actually constitutes both war crimes and crimes against humanity. So that over the period of the summer, we worked out a series of four, which we later expanded to five indictments on the areas of wars of aggression with particular reference to Iraq and Afghanistan, torture and indefinite detention with particular reference to the whole abandonment of international standards concerning the treatment of prisoners of war and the use of torture. But we've added to this the destruction of the global environment, here with a lot of reference to the systematic policies that are contributing to global warming, the attacks on global public health and reproductive rights, in particular what the government has been doing in terms of imposing a Christian fundamentalist agenda on the international health programs that have resulted in closing down many of the anti-AIDS programs in Africa. And, of course, this has a genocidal effect. And the final thing that we have been looking at has been the government's what their response and their lack of response was to the Hurricane Katrina, and what has amounted almost to ethnic cleansing in New Orleans in the aftermath of that natural disaster.
Clark, why this format in particular?
We thought it was important to do two things. One is, if you may remember back, this is in the tradition of people's tribunals, somewhat like the Bertrand Russell Tribunal in 66 and 67, where this government is so lawless in terms of not only of its disrespect for domestic law, but its declaration that it's not bound by any international law whatsoever, that only a people's tribunal could actually convene and bring this evidence together. Even then, if you think back to the Bertrand Russell Tribunal, they had to go to Copenhagen and Stockholm to do it. And we feel that it's the responsibility of Americans in this country to bring their government to heel around these issues. As we say in our charter, that when the possibility of far-reaching war crimes and crimes against humanity exists, people of conscience have a solemn responsibility to inquire into the nature and scope of these acts and to determine if they do in fact rise to the level of war crimes and crimes against humanity. And that's what the mission of the International Commission is.
This is the second tribunal? You had one in Washington before?
No, we had a previous one here in New York in October. This is the first session. This is the second session. And just to correct one thing Michael said at the beginning, the first 2 days, the 20th and the 21st, are going to be at Riverside Church. And the third day, the 22nd, is going to be at the law school at Columbia University.
The 20th is a Friday?
If we begin on a Friday evening at Riverside Church, run during the day on Saturday there, and then in the afternoon at the law school at Columbia.
Can you talk about some of the witnesses?
Well, in our first session, we had quite an all-star cast, beginning with you, Michael.
Did it get better or worse?
Well, we had some. We began with some major voices of conscience at the beginning. We had Marcus Raskin from IPS and Howard Zinn, Michael Ratner, and Ann Wright, the former Foreign Service officer who resigned from the State Department over a protest of the war in Iraq. And then we had a whole series of witnesses that came forward with regard to to global health and the global warming and the health issues. Barbara Olshansky testified with regard to the detentions at Guantanamo. We had on foreign policy Dennis Halliday, Ray McGovern, and we would refer people to our website for the schedule that's being put together for this second session of hearings. I know we're going to be starting off with Ray McGovern is going to be interrogating Scott Ritter.
Clark, remind our listeners who Ray McGovern is.
Okay, Ray McGovern is a former CIA officer who is now one of part of this association of former intelligence officers who are coming out and asking that the people be told the truth about what is going on. And of course, Scott Ritter is the former member of the United Nations weapons inspection teams in Iraq who told the world before the war had begun that Saddam Hussein was disarmed and there was, in fact, no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But we're having witnesses of this level and character who are coming in each of these areas to bring this evidentiary hearing together and establish this kind of record. And we're putting a lot of emphasis on the rigor with which we present the evidence.
Will the proceedings be transcribed or available to people who can't attend?
Yes, they will. The proceedings from the first session are on our website. You can click on the individual witnesses and either hear the audio of their testimony or see the video of it. And eventually, we would hope to have both a DVD set of the hearings as well as some of the key testimony put together in book form.
Clark, I'm going to ask you for that website, and I'm going to also ask you for the date and times, and I want to give our listeners a chance to get a pencil. We've got Clark Kissinger here, who's the convener of the War Crimes Tribunal against the Bush administration, and if people have a pen or pencil, Clark, can you give us the details on this?
Yes. The hearings are going to begin on Friday evening, the 20th, at the Riverside Church, which is 123rd and Riverside Drive. If you're taking the subway, just get off at 116th by Columbia, and they will also be there in the morning and afternoon on Saturday, the 21st. Then on Sunday, the 22nd, at beginning at 1 in the afternoon, we're going to be at the Law School of Columbia University, which is 116th in Amsterdam. And all of the details can be found at our website, which is www.bushcommission.org. Bushcommission.org. We're looking for volunteers here in the New York area to work on this. There's a million tasks to be done, but we feel that this is very important at this time in terms of framing and fueling a debate that's urgently needed in this country around the basic question of, has in fact the Bush administration committed crimes against humanity? Because part of the problem is if they're allowed to get away with this stuff step by step, what happens is the public becomes inured to this. It becomes the new normalcy. People are not stepping out and saying this is absolutely unacceptable. And while I'm excited to hear about all of the attempts that people are doing in terms of impeachment resolutions and congressional investigations and prosecutions and so on, I think we all know that given this government, none of that's going anywhere unless there's a mass movement in this country that's demanding that these people be brought into the docket.
No kidding. Give us that website again, and if you've got a phone number.
BushCommission.org. Bush Commission, one word. www.bushcommission.org. And our office number is 212-941-8086.
Clark, thank you so much for being with us, and best of luck at the tribunal.
And
thank
I want to you. Really encourage people to go. I was at the one a month ago, and they were really amazing. I mean, great witnesses, good cross-examination, and brought out really a lot of the criminality of this administration, a really historic happening. Thank you again, Clark.
Riverside Church starting January 20th. Clark Kissinger, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
It's been all over the news these past few weeks. Claiming it was necessary for national security, the Bush administration has authorized a secret domestic electronic surveillance program in clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. As listeners know, the Fourth Amendment requires a warrant from a court before the government can engage in electronic surveillance of private conversations, whether by telephone or otherwise. A similar assertion of power based on supposed national security arguments was made by President Richard Nixon in the early 70s. In a 1972 decision in the case of United States versus United States District Court, the Supreme Court held that the president had no inherent power to conduct electronic surveillance of domestic groups without a court order, even where it believed they posed a threat to national security. Joining us today is Bill Goodman, Legal Director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome, Bill.
Oh, thank you very much.
Hey, Bill, now tell me quickly. I think, you know, the first case I worked on at the center in 1971 was the brief in that case, U.S. District Court, which challenged Mitchell's domestic wiretapping in the United States. Now, you had some involvement also in some way, right?
I know. I mean, I'm very familiar with that case because I'm from Detroit, and the case arises out of Detroit. And I knew John, I still know John Sinclair and Punt Lamund, and then the lawyers who worked from Detroit who worked on that case, Buck Davis and others. So, and the judge, who was Dave and Keith, I know very well. So I wasn't directly involved in that.
Right, but that was the 72 case that said that there is no sort of warrantless wiretapping you can do against U.S. citizens in the name of national security. Is that
case,
right?
Which was a 9-0 opinion
right.
by the United States Supreme Court, stands for the proposition the president may not suspend the Constitution simply based upon an assertion of national security, which is really exactly what we're seeing in a repeat performance right now, yes.
Now, one thing about that case that was interesting, the old case, the 72 case, and then a later case that you represented people in, is those were raised in the context of criminal cases where the government was going to use evidence that was based on taps or wiretapping that did not have warrants. And therefore, they had to dismiss the criminal indictment in the case that went to the Supreme Court, and I think in a case that you handled as well, right?
Yeah, there was a case on behalf of the leadership of the Weather Underground, actually, at the time that I was involved in. That was also in front of Damon Keith. In that case, he compelled the government to produce all of its secret surveillance wiretap and infiltration records, and when they refused to do it, they were forced to dismiss that case. That was actually slightly after the Keith case, after the United States Supreme Court opinion, and they didn't feel like appealing again because they just gotten kicked in the teeth.
One of the reasons I'm raising that, those were criminal cases that used unlawful wiretapping, is that obviously what comes up today in NSA using unlawful wiretapping is it jeopardizes, if that's the right word, probably all of the so-called terrorism cases that the United States has prosecuted, or at least it certainly puts questions into your mind as to whether evidence in those cases came from these taps.
It certainly does. I think that every lawyer, and I had one of these cases also, who has defended anyone in a terrorism trial, is compelled, I think, at this point to seek additional disclosure to find out whether there was any illegal wiretapping and see whether or not, and then make a motion to dismiss based upon that fact, yes.
Yes, my thinking here is that here the so-called, you know, war on terror that the president is carrying out and using NSA spying supposedly to get farther on, he's actually jeopardized his so-called hallmarks of his administration, these criminal cases.
It certainly jeopardizes an effective attack on terrorism, yeah.
Hi, Bill. It's Michael Smith here.
Yes, hi, Michael.
What do you think this has to do with the Lynn Stewart conviction?
I assume that Lynn's lawyers are going to make a motion and force or attempt to compel a disclosure of any additional electronic interceptions which they received, whether they were telephone calls or cell phone calls or emails or whatever, and it opens up a new approach or possibility for the defense in that case, it seems to me.
Bill, in the case that we were discussing, U.S. v. U.S. District Court, the Supreme Court did not reach the issue of whether the president could conduct electronic surveillance of foreign agents in the U.S. without a warrant.
No, but it explicitly reserved on that point, yes.
But then in 1978, Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or
That's
FISA.
Right.
Could you
FISA.
Briefly explain that?
The FISA Act, or Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, allows the administration to go to a special court to seek a warrant to engage in wiretapping of anyone who is both within the United States and certainly for calls going outside of the United States to tap the phones of anyone in the United States who is who they can establish some basis, and it's really short of probable cause, but some reasonable suspicion that there is criminality, and in this case, terrorism afoot. So that, and then the judge, without any notice to the other, to the person who's being tapped, without any opportunity to hear any arguments, signs a warrant, and the government goes ahead and taps their line so that, that people are being overheard who have no idea that this is going on. The only real protection is that it at least forces the government to say, this is what we have on this person, this is why we want to surveil them, and some judge then has some oversight over the process. So it is at least some break, some ability of the judicial system to provide oversight on an executive branch that otherwise would go out of control with power. And in this case, shockingly, the Bush administration has gone ahead and allowed surveillance of people, allowed wiretapping, allowed interception of emails, without any oversight whatsoever. And this is a court which I hesitate to call it a rubber stamp, but a court which almost always gives the government what it asks.
We hate this court. This court is an underground court.
This court
it's
is
a secret court.
It's a court. It's a court that meets in the top floor of the Justice Department. It's a court in a room with no windows. No one knows who's there, who uses it, what they do. In the last several years, they've issued something like 10,000 warrants, and they've only denied, what, one? It's a rubber stamp. But what puzzles me, Bill Goodman, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, what puzzles me, and I'd ask you for your speculation, given that it's a rubber stamp, why would they not use it?
Well, in my opinion, there have been a lot of, I think, very confused statements by the administration supporting this policy and supporting circumventing FISA. And none of them make any sense because they can even do it retroactively. They can intercept someone's call or someone's email and then go have they have 72 hours to go back to FISA and get approval, retroactive approval for what they've done. None of it makes any sense. My own speculation on this is that they are engaging in wiretapping on a basis that would be shocking even to these conservative FISA judges. And I suspect it's lawyers, and I suspect it is perhaps mainstream politicians.
No, we suspect, Bill, I know you and I have talked about this, that because we are the center and you and all of us are representing the Guantanamo people, we suspect that what they're doing is, and we have calls to foreign countries, that we're probably subject to these taps, very likely. And if they were to go to the Foreign Surveillance Court saying we're tapping attorneys, they might cause a problem.
I think that that's right. I think the center is probably the most likely kind of organization, maybe the most likely organization to have had this happen, and I would not be at all surprised. In fact, I think it's probably the case that we have been.
Well, it's the center, and not only the center, but the center and its affiliates. And in the current period, there are a lot of people who are not, I would not characterize them with the same sort of politics that those of us associated with the center have, but nonetheless are Republican-minded in the best sense of the word. And these people are also influential people in private law firms, people who care about the Constitution and care
and
about
the
separation
representing the Guantanamo
powers.
People.
They're representing the Guantanamo people, and I wouldn't be surprised to share your speculation, Bill. The government was not using the FISA court, so it could tap the phones of some of the more established law firms in America.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And that some judge, seeing the fact that they've gone into some of these silk stocking law firms and that these phones indeed have been tapped, would be very shocked. And this is something they simply don't want to disclose. And that's why I think that may be one of the reasons that they have.
I think there's another reason, Bill. As we see when the president did the signing order on the McCain Amendment and asserts broad presidential authority outside of the Constitution, not outside of the Constitution, but outside of Congress and outside of the courts, he's trying to assert incredible presidential power here. I mean, incredible. And they talk about what's called a unitary executive in which the executive, it's almost can nullify laws of Congress in the name of the Constitution, his view of the constitutional power, or nullify court decisions. And I actually, when you heard Cheney talk about this and other things, he said, we want to put to rest what happened after the Vietnam War. We're tired of having an executive that's chained down, really, by the courts and by weak-kneed Congress as it is. And so I think, you know, underneath here, that may be another issue.
Yeah, I really agree. I think this is the pattern with this administration over and over and over again, and we've seen it consistently in one way after another that this administration has gone out of its way to assert as much power as it possibly can, to acquire as much power as it possibly can, and to flout the other branches of government. I think separation of powers over more and more and more is becoming a critical issue, a life and death issue for democracy.
You know, someone told me they're teaching a new presidential salute. Did you hear anything about this?
But, you know, Bill, when I was working with Bill Kunstler's daughters on editing the book, which we came to title The Emerging Police State, Michael Ratner wrote the introduction to it. And Michael and I kind of shook our heads. This was a couple years ago, and we thought, well, The Emerging Police State, that's a little edgy. That sounds a little shrill. Maybe we shouldn't use that title. But, you know, in retrospect, unfortunately, I think we were absolutely right. That's what's emerging.
I'm afraid that we are really grappling with that kind of problem, with a police state that is out of control, really. And what makes it out of control is that there are no limits whatsoever. Neither of the other branches of government have any limits on it.
Bill, one thing when we were talking about the broad authority the president's asserting, I think it leads into the next thing that we want to talk to you, which is the new possible Supreme Court Justice Alito and what his views might be about that. And I think that's – I know you've been looking at that and examining that. If you can give us some take on I guess he's currently a judge and hopefully will stay at best a judge.
And while you gather your thoughts, Bill, let me just remind our listeners. We're speaking with Bill Goodman, who's the legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. I'm here with Michael Ratner, the center's president, Heidi Boghossian, who's the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. I'm Michael Smith. Bill, what's your thoughts on the rise of Alito?
Well, I think that, you know, the question with Alito, everyone is raising the question, you know, what is he going to do with Roe versus Wade? Is he going to overrule Roe versus Wade? What about his position in Baker versus Carr, which was the so-called one man, one vote opinion by the United States Supreme Court? You know, it's really not a question of a single issue. It is a question of where does this judge and all of Bush's judicial appointments stand on deference to executive power. That's the point that I think that if Congress is smart, you have people at the hearings who really want to make this point over and over again. The questions to these candidates, and to Alito especially, should be, where do you stand on the ability of the president to just go around the world, pick up people who are non-citizens of the United States at the moment, and in some cases who are citizens, throw them into the dark hole of Guantanamo or other prisons without any trial? It's the question of the executive to act as a local cop and thug that is now at stake. And I think Alito, over and over again throughout his career, has shown his willingness over and over and over again to side with the government. Not 100%. He's been careful once or twice to go the other way, but I think this is someone who votes consistently and constantly in favor of executive power and in favor of the government violating the rights of individual citizens and against the rights of individual citizens to raise these issues in a court, to act as private enforcers of the Constitution, which we all are and should be. And in addition to that, I might say, over and over and over again, he has consistently ruled with large corporations against victims, people who have been injured. He is someone who votes with power, and whether that power be corporate power or whether it be governmental power. I don't think we can forget the fact that Mussolini defined fascism as the moment at which large corporate interests and business take control of government. And I think that this is the danger with Alito. It's not one thing or another. Those are incredibly important. It's the whole picture, and this is someone who I fear is going to simply approve what we were just talking about, which is the aggrandizement of executive power.
Well, right after this show, Bill, the hearings will begin, and we really appreciate your insights on this nomination.
My pleasure.
Seems I've got to have a change of scene.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work. I've got to leave before I start to scream. Someone's locked the door and took the key. You're feeling all right. I'm not feeling too good myself. Well, you're feeling all right. I'm not feeling too good myself. Well, boy, you sure took me for one big ride. And even now I sit and wonder why. But when I think of you, I start to cry. Just can't waste my time, I must keep dry. Gotta stop believing in all your lies. Cause there's too much to do before I die. You're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself.
It's today. Can't get up yet, and so I'm here to stay. Till someone comes along and takes my place. With a different name, yes, a different face. You're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself. Well, you're feeling alright.